I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. Is Democracy Now!
The momentous breakthrough that we're here to celebrate tonight is more than the end of the war in Gaza. It's with God's help, it'll be the new beginning for an entire beautiful Middle East.
As President Trump celebrates the ceasefire hostage deal, major questions remain over what happens next. We'll look at the Gaza summit in Egypt and go to the Gaza Strip to speak with Al Jazeera's Hani Mahmoud.
No one expected to survive this relentless genocide. No one at all. Every day we woke up saying, thank you, we're alive.
Plus, we speak to the Israeli Knesset member who was ejected from President Trump's address for holding a sign that read, recognize Palestine.
I've seen it over. Yeah.
And we go to Physicians for Human Rights Israel to talk about the Gaza doctors who are still being held in prison, including the pediatrician Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, the director of the Kamel Adwan Hospital. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Humanitarian aid has begun to trickle into the Gaza Strip, where over 2 million people have faced widespread starvation and malnutrition following Israel's two-year assault that the United Nations and human rights groups have condemned as a genocide. Earlier today, Israeli military forces in Gaza City killed at least five Palestinians, despite the ceasefire agreement that took effect last Friday. Separately, at least three children were injured Monday by what appeared to be unexploded Israeli ordnance dropped near Al-Shifa Hospital. The United Nations has warned it could take more than a decade to defuse and clean up unexploded bombs and other explosives left behind by Israeli forces. On Monday, thousands of Palestinians gathered in Khan Yunis and the West Bank to celebrate the return of nearly 2,000 Palestinian prisoners and captives freed as part of the ceasefire deal. Many of those released had been jailed by Israel without charge or trial. They showed signs of starvation, medical neglect, and torture. This is 48-year-old Palestinian Majid Abi, who was detained nearly 2 years ago.
The situation is extremely, extremely hard for young men. No food, no drink, no medical care. They face constant oppression, torment. I wish everyone would pay attention to their situation. May God protect everyone. Thank God. It's an indescribable feeling.
Another 154 Palestinian prisoners were deported by Israel to Egypt rather than return to occupied Palestine. Meanwhile, Israeli authorities say they've identified the bodies of four hostages returned by Hamas as part of the ceasefire deal, while families express anger that the bodies of 24 other Israelis have not yet been returned. Human rights groups say Israel holds the bodies of over 700 Palestinians, including dozens of children, who Israel has used as bargaining chips in negotiations. On Monday, President Trump co-chaired a summit in Sharm el-Sheikh with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. The leaders of over two dozen countries were in attendance for the ceasefire signing ceremony. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu did not attend. We'll have more on the Gaza ceasefire deal and the exchange of Israeli and Palestinian hostages after headlines. A journalist who was abducted by Israeli forces last week as she accompanied a Gaza-bound humanitarian aid vessel says she was tortured in Israeli custody alongside activists seeking to break Israel's siege on Gaza. Noah Avishag Schnall described the abuse in a video statement to Dropsite News, with bruises from her ordeal clearly visible on her face.
Any flotilla member who upset the Israeli guards was subjected to twisted and tightened handcuffs, and some received beatings. I was hung from the metal shackles on my wrists and ankles and beaten in the stomach, back, face, ear, and skull by a group of men and women guards, one of whom sat on my neck and face, blocking my airways. Many comrades, understandably, do not want their identity made public when recounting this treatment. During the evening, the men were tormented by guards with attack dogs and guns. The women were threatened with pepper spray. Our cell was awoken with threats of rape.
In Afghanistan, the Taliban government says its forces killed dozens of Pakistani soldiers in border clashes over the weekend in retaliation for airstrikes in Kabul and the bombing of a market in eastern Afghanistan last Thursday. The fighting's halted all trade and transit between the two countries, stranding hundreds of Afghan refugees.
We are stranded here because of the war. People say there is fighting at the border. Children, women, and the elderly here with us are sick. There is no water or food. We don't have enough money to survive here for even a few days. They should resolve their issues through dialogue. In war, both countries lose. No one benefits.
Russian forces attacked Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, with guided bombs overnight Monday, plunging 30,000 Ukrainians into darkness after targeting power transmission lines. Four people were injured when three of the bombs struck a hospital.
The first strike was somewhere farther away, and the second, it was very loud. The door flew out. My window burst open. I'm just lucky that I have a ward on the other side. I just sat down, very scared. My heart ached. Not all the wards were fully occupied, but there were people there who suffered from glass injuries because the windows blew out.
Russia's latest attack comes as the International Atomic Energy Agency is pressing Moscow and Kyiv to agree to local ceasefires in order to restore electricity to the Russian-occupied Zaporizhzhia power plant, Europe's largest nuclear facility. The plant's been operating on backup diesel generators since September 23rd after fighting severed power lines, leaving it vulnerable to a nuclear disaster. It's the 10th time, and by far the longest, the plant has lost outside power. Meanwhile, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has announced plans to meet President Trump at the White House Friday as he seeks additional weapons, including long-range Tomahawk missiles. In Washington, the federal government shutdown has entered its 14th day. Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson's warning this could be the longest shutdown in U.S. history. The Senate's expected to vote today for the eighth time to fully fund the federal government. Senate Democrats say they won't approve new spending until Republicans agree to extend expiring health care subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. These shutdowns cause flight delays, shut off access to national parks, closed taxpayers' helplines at the IRS, and impacted the permitting process at the Environmental Protection Agency and the Transportation Department. Military personnel and their families have increasingly turned to food pantries to make ends meet. Meanwhile, several airports across the country are refusing to air a video PSA of Department of Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem blaming Democrats for the shutdown and resulting flight delays. A spokesperson for Portland International Airport told the Washington Post, quote, "We believe the Hatch Act clearly prohibits use of public assets for political purposes and messaging," unquote. The Washington Post, the New York Times, the Associated Press, and CNN, as well as conservative outlets Newsmax and Washington Times, all announced they will not sign the Pentagon's new press policy by today's deadline. The policy states media outlets and reporters cannot obtain any information that the Pentagon does not explicitly authorize. Matt Murray, the Washington Post executive editor, said, quote, "The proposed restrictions undercut First Amendment protections by placing unnecessary constraints on gathering and publishing information," unquote. In response, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth posted on X a hand-waving emoji. A 2003 CIA cable details stunning torture methods against a detainee at a black site carried out without permission and removed from reports to headquarters. The cable recounts how an interrogator put a cordless drill close to Abdulrahim al-Nashiri's body and pressed the on switch and let the drill run. The incident reportedly took place weeks after al-Nashiri was waterboarded at the CIA black site. A handgun was also held to his head after he'd been forced to stay awake for 2.5 days in a stress position, which involved chaining his arms above his head while he was naked or wearing only a diaper. Al-Nashiri was later charged in the 2000 bombing of the USS Cole. A military judge, Colonel Lanny Acosta Jr., rejected al-Nashiri's statements in detention, writing, quote, any resistance the accused might have been inclined to put up when asked to incriminate himself was intentionally and literally beaten out of him years before, unquote. Al-Nashiri's trial is set to start in June 2026. Madagascar's president says he's fled the country following Gen Z protests that erupted last month demanding his ouster and after soldiers threw their support behind the protests. Reuters reports Andry Rajoelina left Madagascar on Sunday aboard a French military aircraft. A crackdown and descent by his forces killed at least 22 people, according to the United Nations. On Monday, thousands gathered in Madagascar's capital to mourn the dead and to demand justice.
The evacuation of Andry Rajoelina was an act of interference by France in Madagascar. Why? Well, because it wasn't a coup d'etat. It was just a call from the people, a call for freedom of expression.
The United Nations warns some 300,000 people have fled South Sudan this year amidst renewed fighting that's threatening to return the nation to civil war. The conflict grew worse after the arrest of the first president, Riek Machar, unraveled a fragile power-sharing agreement. Sudan gained UN recognition as the world's newest nation in 2011, but a civil war that erupted in 2013 led to an estimated 400,000 deaths. A coalition of leading economists and former finance ministers is calling for immediate debt relief to low and middle income nations, warning loan repayments are squeezing out government funding for basic services, leading to poverty and preventable deaths. In a letter to the World Bank and IMF ahead of annual meetings this week, the economists, including Columbia University professor Joe Stiglitz, write, quote, countries around the world are paying exorbitant debt servicing costs instead of paying for schools, hospitals, climate action or other essential services, unquote. In Mexico, at least 64 people are dead. Dozens remain missing after tropical storms triggered severe flooding across five states. Authorities say some 100,000 homes have been affected. In Alaska, Coast Guard and National Guard search and rescue crews have rescued dozens of people in coastal villages on the Bering Sea after the remnants of Typhoon Halong brought hurricane-force winds, storm surge, and severe flooding to the region. Meanwhile, on the U.S. East Coast, at least three people are dead as a slow-moving nor'easter brings coastal flooding winds and heavy rain to mid-Atlantic and northeastern states for a fourth consecutive day. A recent study authored by the University of Pennsylvania climate scientists, including Michael Mann, found human-driven climate change is making the strongest nor'easters even stronger. New York Attorney General Letitia James spoke publicly for the first time since her federal indictment at a campaign rally for New York City mayoral candidate Zohran Mamdani Monday. James has been indicted on mortgage fraud charges, which she denies, after President Trump called for his political enemies to be jailed. She's being prosecuted by Trump's handpicked U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of Virginia, Lindsey Halligan, after Trump forced out the previous Trump-appointed U.S. attorney for refusing to bring charges. At the rally, Mamdani and James presented a united front against President Trump, warning about the threat he poses to democracy, they said.
We are witnessing the fraying of our democracy, the erosion of our system of government. This, my friends, is a defining moment in our history. Let us stand together to defend our rights, to protect every safeguard, every institution, every immigrant.
We are an existential threat to billionaires who think their money can buy our democracy. We are an existential threat to a broken status quo that buries the voices of working people beneath corporations. And we are an existential threat to a New York where a hard day's work isn't enough to earn you a good night's rest.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we begin today's show in Israel, where the family members of the 20 remaining released hostages are welcoming their loved ones home. On Monday, as President Trump addressed the Israeli Knesset, a group of leftist Israeli lawmakers briefly interrupted his speech, shouting at President Trump and waving signs that said, "Recognize Palestine."
Everybody loves Steve, and they respect him, and they somehow can relate to him. I've known him for many years, and I've seen it over again. That was very efficient.
The two lawmakers were Eman Odeh and Ofer Kassif. They're members of the Hadash Tal Alliance. Footage shows Professor Rashid Khalidi's book, The 100 Years War on Palestine, resting on MK, that's member of Knesset, Kassif's desk as he's sitting before being ousted. He'll join us in a minute. After the two lawmakers were expelled from the Knesset, the Hadash Tal head Eman Odeh shared this message.
I was kicked out of the Knesset for raising the simplest demand, one of the whole international community agrees on. Recognize the state of Palestine. Recognize the simple truth. There are two peoples here, and no one is going anywhere.
That's the Palestinian member of the parliament, Eman Odeh. We're joined now by Ofer Kassif, a Jewish-Israeli member of the Knesset and the leftist Hadash Tal coalition. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, sir. If you can start off by describing exactly what happened. You have, for the first time, President Trump addressing the Israeli Knesset before taking off for Egypt, where he signed the ceasefire deal. Talk about what you did.
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. Yesterday, there was a disgusting display of flattery and personality cult by two megalomaniacs who are hungry for power and blood. That's the main bond between Netanyahu and Trump. And we use this opportunity, which I dare say, or I would like to say, that luckily doesn't happen too often, that someone like Trump attends the Knesset. And we used it to display our signs calling for the recognition of the state of Palestine. This was a minimum, and I would say even polite protest against the policy of mainly the government of Israel, the genocidal government of Israel, the government that sacrificed the Israeli hostages and the even Israeli soldiers on the altar of messianic crazy ideas. And all of that was taking place under the auspices of the governments of the United States, in plural, Biden and later on Trump. And this is was our protest against the policy that both share. That's the reason we did it.
And Ofer Kassif, I wanted to ask you the
there's been much made here in the United States of Trump's initiative to create this peace plan. But to what degree do you feel what happened in the weeks before, especially at the UN General Assembly, as one U.S. ally after another, Canada, Australia, the United Kingdom, France, Portugal, recognized the state of Palestine? What impact do you think that had on pushing forward this this ceasefire?
First of all, I totally agree, if that's what you wanted to imply, that the main reason for the change in President Trump's policy towards the genocide in Gaza is the change, are the changes that have been occurring throughout the globe. First of all, it's the huge demonstrations of different peoples across the globe, in Europe, in America, in Australia, in East Asia, etc., etc. Millions of people, of good people, of peace activists, people who were terrified by the pictures from what was going on in Gaza. Those demonstrations, for sure, influenced, had their impact on Trump. And same about those leaders like Sanchez in Spain, or Petro in Colombia and others. There's no doubt that if we should thank someone for the end, for ending the genocide and releasing the Israeli hostages, it's not Trump, let alone Netanyahu. It is the demonstrations that I mentioned and some of the leaders in the of different countries in the world. And the proof is that a couple of days ago, President Trump told Prime Minister Netanyahu, and I quote, almost a word by word, Israel cannot stand against the whole world. Why did he say that? He said so specifically because he was witnessing those demonstrations and change of mood, including the recognition by 150 states, recognition of the state of Palestine and the two-state solution. So no doubt that that was the main impact on Trump. Alas, he still hasn't gone enough, far enough, to say explicitly that the two-state solution and the liberation of the Palestinian people are a must, and I hope that you will.
And what is your sense now of the impact on Israeli society and on your democracy of this peace plan and the fate of Netanyahu in the future?
First of all, if I may refer to what you said about Israel as a democracy, it pops out to my mind, you know, something that Mahatma Gandhi said. He was asked once what he thought about British civilization. And he said, I think it's a wonderful idea. So if you ask me what I think about the Israeli democracy, I would answer the same. I think it's a wonderful idea. Unfortunately, we are not there yet. That's not a democracy, but perhaps that's for another chat. But the influence of the change in the international atmosphere does influence the public discourse within Israel. Still too little and too late, but it's better than nothing and never. You could see that throughout the demonstrations in the last 2 years against the so-called war, which I prefer to call a genocide, to the demonstrations that called to release the hostages by sealing a deal that will end the genocide. You could see throughout those 2 years, and we participated in those demonstrations all the time since the beginning. Within those demonstrations, there were two main voices. One voice focused on the fate of the Israeli hostages and soldiers and totally ignored the fate of the Palestinians. The other voice, which we led and was in the beginning in a tiny minority, said that we do, of course, care a lot and want to release the hostages and stop the bloodshed of Israeli soldiers too. But obviously we also emphasized the terrible death toll and destruction, etc., in Gaza and of Palestinians. We were in the beginning quite isolated and marginalized, sometimes even physically attacked. But you could see that throughout, as time went by, we began to get to gain more and more support. So towards the end, we, I guess, constituted perhaps 20-30% of the demonstrators. So that, of course, shows that the public discourse and the public opinion within Israel did shift. You could also see that in different organizations from below, so to speak, by workers, you know, social workers, physicians, professors, teachers, artists, and writers who began to raise a voice in the last few months against the genocide in Gaza, using the term genocide clearly and explicitly, like the very famous writer David Grossman did in an interview to La Repubblica, an Italian newspaper. And no less importantly is that no less than 600 ex-generals in the so-called Israeli security services also signed a petition in which they referred to the ongoing situation in Gaza as ethnic cleansing and war crimes and called to stop that. So you could see a change in the public discourse and in the public opinion in Israel. And of course, as the demonstrations in the world grew, it also influenced some of the Israeli discourse. And so in the end, you could see this kind of a influence of the international community on the Israeli public.
During his address to the Knesset Monday, President Trump suggested Netanyahu should be pardoned on corruption charges. This is what he said.
Hey, I have an idea. Mr. President, why don't you give him a pardon? You know, whether we like it or not, this has been one of the greatest wartime presidents. This has been one of the greatest wartime presidents. And cigars and champagne, who the hell cares about that?
So that's President Trump calling for Netanyahu to be pardoned. Can you talk about the significance of this, Ofer Kassif, and for people to understand, many believe that he extended the assault on Gaza to extend his own trial, to put off the end of that trial. And we're not even talking here about the charges in the International Court of Crimes Against Humanity.
Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. But we should add to that that Netanyahu is not alone. If you put the all blame on Netanyahu, we missed a great deal of others who are totally blamed for the carnage that took place in Gaza and the sacrifice of the Israeli hostages as well. Those are combined through totally, and there's no way to distinguish between them. So Netanyahu, on the one hand, is interested only in his own good. Just like Trump, I mean, those two psychopaths are good friends. It's not a coincidence. One criminal endorses the other criminal. And whether we are talking about crimes of corruption or other crimes, including crimes against humanity or war crimes, etc., etc. So as far as Netanyahu himself is concerned, from the very beginning, he was interested in doing whatever possible to stay in power, and by that, to refrain from being behind bars. That's his only interest. He doesn't care about the well-being of the Israelis, including the hostages, and obviously, let alone the well-being of Palestinians. And because of that, he formed a coalition and a government that in the past, he himself refused to form, because he knows exactly who we are dealing with. We are dealing with messianic bigots. We are dealing with lethal fascists. But Netanyahu decided to join forces with them, to add them and to base his government and coalition on them, not only, by the way, in the sense of collaborating with bigots like Benfield and Smotrich, that is to say, two and other parties, but to change the Likud party from within. Let's not forget that in the last few years, Netanyahu transformed totally the Likud party. The Likud party, which was never my cup of tea, but the Likud party had, you know, serious politicians, people with values, which I do not share, which I object, but still with values and some respect and